Atheist Nomads, episode 360. Not Your Grandmother's Book Club.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin, and in a little bit, I'll be joined by Kevin and Benedict from Not Your Grandmother's Book Club. And that was recorded on May 31, so there is a little bit of time-sensitive discussion about the protests that were going on at that time, but the discussion's still good, and we'll go ahead and I'm just leaving that in. We're going to be doing a live stream for next week's episode. We, you know, would have been trying to get it to every, you know, at least if it ends in a zero. Didn't quite work out this time, so we're going to shoot for Tuesday, June 23 at 8:30 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time. And then the next week, the episode that normally be out on the 2nd of July, I will actually be taking off. That'll give me some time to finish up rebuilding the roof on the pop-up camper, and then we'll be going camping for like 5 days. should be pretty awesome. But in the news, there's actually some good news, so we definitely have to talk about this. In a 6-3 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court concluded that sexual orientation and gender identity fall under the worker protections of Title VII of the 1963 Civil Rights Act. This basic premise is something that I know it's been going around in the courts some for the last quite a few years. I heard it with when the same-sex marriage cases were working their way through. I know they were talking about it in the Ninth Circuit appeal hearing for the Idaho case. And the basic idea is that, so you say a man is dating or married to a man. If you're going to discriminate based on that, then, but you wouldn't have an issue with that man being married to a woman, then the issue is someone's sex. So that's, you know, if that, say your employee that you'd be discriminating against was a woman married to a man instead of a man married to a man, then you, that's obviously just sex-based discrimination and not permissible under Title VII. For gender identity, that also plays in where, okay, you're a trans person. If you weren't, you'd be okay. Well, that's because you aren't fitting the gender norms that the person has in their mind that you should be. Therefore, they're going to discriminate. Well, that's definitely sex-based discrimination. If you lived up to those norms that they would expect you to do, then you'd be fine. So this is a really big win, especially considering how conservative the current Supreme Court is. You know, they got the 4 liberal justices, which was expected, plus John Roberts and Gorsuch. And What's really interesting is Pod Save America had an interview with one of the lawyers who had been working on this for the ACLU. They planned their entire case in the Supreme Court on getting Gorsuch. Like, they were just presenting to him because they knew that if they could get him, they would definitely get Roberts. And he was the one that they figured that they could probably win over because he is a strict textualist. If a plain reading of something will give you the answer, then that's what he wants to go with. So a plain reading of any legislation about sex-based discrimination, it's kind of hard to say that, you know, somebody's relationships are not fitting with sex and gender norms doesn't get protected by that. So This is pretty big. It's not everything we could possibly want. It's not saying that every single protection for sex-based discrimination applies to sexual orientation and gender identity yet. This creates precedent, and we'll work through the courts, and we'll push executive agencies and states into not pushing their luck and losing in court. Because this is now precedent that, yeah, that's what that means. At present, it only applies to employment. But with any luck, here within a few years, after a few court cases, hopefully getting Joe Biden in the White House to undo the 30-some-odd anti-LGBT executive orders and policies the Trump administration has done. You know, get rid of those, get some protections back in place, advance this. And then, yeah, there'll be some states like Texas or Alabama or Idaho who will fight it. Probably going to be Idaho as one of them, considering the recent two anti-trans bills that are now law. So, yeah, we could expect those to go to the courts very quickly if they aren't already working. I'm pretty sure they are already working their way through the courts. But, yeah, they're going to lose. They will lose at the district court. They will definitely lose at the circuit court. And I'm going to guess Idaho wouldn't want to take it to the Supreme Court because that costs a lot of money. So this should work out pretty well in the long run with legally protected discrimination going away, which it needs to. So, like I was talking about last week, and if you look at some of the news about some of the changes that are happening already being announced with police departments, this is a time where we can be optimistic. Yes, you still need to fight. You still need to, if you're protesting, you need to do the protest. We need to keep putting pressure on the elected officials. We all need to make sure we vote. But there is good reason to be optimistic that we're in a, you know, shitty hiccup before things continue to get better. And on that note, let's move on to the interview. And we are now joined by Kevin and Benedict from the Not Your Grandmother's Book Club podcast. Welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
See, I was waiting for Benedict to go first, so there's that nice pause in there, which now, because I've mentioned it, you can't edit it out. You have to leave that dead air in.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. That's my bad. Kevin normally leads everything on our podcast. He's very much in charge, and I just react to everything that he says because, honestly, he is just a lot more prepared as a person to face this world than I am.
I have been well-trained.
I am here to be... have encyclopedic knowledge and be occasionally funny. That's
okay.
So encyclopedic knowledge of just exclusively weird stuff, though, like useful, like just you know, 19th century Spanish and Portuguese literature. That's mostly it, actually.
God, you're so boring.
Man, Spanish and which century did you say?
Well, it varies. Everything from the 13th to the mid-20th. Yeah, no,
don't encourage him. Don't stroke that ego.
we will come back to this because there's got to be a story
Deal.
There.
Deal. All right. No, I mean, the story is I studied it, but we can come back to it.
is that what your degree's in?
Yeah. Yeah.
Classical Iberian Peninsula literature?
Precisely, yeah. Well, actually, I mean, Hispanic and Lusophone literature more broadly. So I also did Mozambican and Brazilian, etc. But yes. So, yeah.
And was it specific to classical or was modern literature included?
Modern was included as well. My master's is in medieval literature, but I have a bachelor's in all Hispanic and Portuguese literature, technically.
Wow. So what level of fluency did you have to have in the various forms of those languages?
Pretty high, yeah. It's, you know how you read Old English and it's like, this isn't real words? Yeah. that's the same in Spanish, pretty much. Not as bad, but it's like, hey, this is, looks like Latin rather than Spanish. So you have, I had to keep track of all the forms of all the languages.
Well, and especially considering that you go back far enough and it's not Spanish, it's Vulgar Latin.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. That's a little further back.
Yeah.
But my,
you know what?
My,
he can't even read Esperanto. So what value does he have?
Pero vamos, podemos hablar en español si quiere. Si quieres hacer el podcast en español o en portugués también. Puedes hablar en portugués.
Now do that again, but with the South American version of that accent.
Es verdad, ¿no?
Can I curse on this podcast?
Yeah.
Si quiere hacer el brasileiro, puedo hacer eso también.
Okay,
fine.
So
all right, I'll stop now. But there you go.
And actually, you can cuss in any language in this on this podcast. So.
Okay, great. Good to know.
Preferable is, you know, English, but yeah.
Okay, I will speak English henceforth.
Okay,
as if I've been yelled at by a right wing asshole. So I will only speak English.
So Benedict, you got a bachelor's and master's in obscure literature for the English speaking world.
Correct. Which is why I'm now the literature expert on the podcast that we have.
And then moved to the US.
Indeed, yes. You know, it's a Spanish-speaking country, in my opinion.
Well, if you're looking for people who natively speak Spanish or Portuguese, there's a lot more here than in Britain.
That is certainly true. Yeah, that is definitely true. But yeah, I'm here. Been here for like 3 years now.
And I keep trying to call ICE on him and get him kicked out, but it just doesn't work.
Yeah, as we've said, I'm extremely too white for that, fortunately.
See, that solidarity joke only works against white people because of against people of color, it's cruel and mean.
Yes, all solidarity to my brothers and sisters who are not as lucky as I am.
Right, yeah. Be brought over on a slave ship, or have your ancestors brought over on a slave ship 400 years ago, lived in the U.S. forever, get beat by the cops or murdered by the cops, have a British accent and a bald white head, and you're just fine.
Yep, that's exactly where I am. Yep. That's
I do like that you brought up he was bald. I do enjoy
that. Yeah, nobody needed to know that, Dustin.
Oh, sorry.
It's an audio format.
That's slightly cruel, but that's okay.
Excuse me, with a white face and British accent.
Yep, and kind of a ruddy head, honestly, like a
beautiful,
little on the red
full
side.
Full set of hair. I don't know why Dustin was lying about you, Benedict. It's really cruel that he would make up
Thank
that bald
you,
head thing.
Kevin. Do you know what actually happened is I met my wife and my hair all immediately fell out. Like that's literally what happened.
Wow.
They were like, you better cling on to this one because
she's
you're getting
hear
up
you
here.
In the next room and come in and slap you.
Yeah, she might slap my big bald head. That is.
And then Kevin, you're a law student.
Yes, indeed. I am. I am a law student. Been that for about 2 years now, going into my last year of law school.
All right. And from California originally.
Cali! Yeah, NorCal, all the way. Sacramento, as a matter of fact. The little-known capital of the state, which I'm not sure most people are aware of. But I think most people think that
people
the capital
know
of California,
that. I
people,
knew that.
Some people know. You'd be surprised how many people I meet who think that the capital of California is L.A. or San Francisco.
Well, to be fair, it should be.
Probably. But I need some claim to fame for my hometown.
It's weird. That's a weird thing about America. They're like, hey, let's name the capital. And then they're like, not the city everyone's heard of. Not that one. That would be silly. Well, and I know it's because it was done before the cities got really big and important. I understand that as a concept. I just still think it's stupid.
You even get some crazier ones with like Washington, where they were going to determine what would be the capital of the compressed down Washington territory, and they gave the three largest cities the choice between the capital, the land grant college, and the prison. The largest picked the prison.
What?
The second largest picked the capital, and the third largest got stuck with the land grant college.
Did they, was it like rock, paper, scissors? Like how did they pick?
They went to they went to Walla Walla and asked them, what do you want? They said the prison. Because they didn't want want politicians or They didn't think the land grant colleges were going to keep getting funding. And they knew there would always be funding for a prison.
That's, in this country, yes. Yeah, that is true.
Yeah. And at that time, Seattle was not even a logging town.
Wow. That's crazy. What year was this?
That would have been the 1880s. shortly before Washington got statehood. And actually, Seattle probably was actually a logging town by that point, but just a really insignificant little village. Not the largest city in the Northwest like it is now.
Still pretty insignificant because grunge has died.
But Sacramento, most people don't know, is the hottest, most sweltery hellhole in California.
Can confirm.
Yeah, weren't you just there?
I was just there for the last 2 weeks helping my parents out with some stuff. Yeah, we had a string of 105 degree days.
That's too hot, man.
Not a lot of fun.
But yeah, so another bone I have to pick with America is the Fahrenheit system. First of all, your capitals are stupid. Get better capitals.
You came up with the Fahrenheit system. That was and you guys.
I didn't. It's not. It's no.
You don't
my
get
name
to complain
is not.
About
I am not Benedict Fahrenheit. I will give you soccer, and I can tell you the story behind why that's called soccer afterwards. But yeah, Fahrenheit. It's like zero. I guess like it is the idea that like Celsius is like okay, water exists between 0 and 100. Humans in Fahrenheit exist between 0 and 100. That is the hottest and coldest humans should ever be. Is that how that works?
I disagree. I think there's a much narrower range in there where humans should be. I don't know if I'd like to go live in the Antarctic at 0 degrees.
Okay, it was the British who came up with it in the first place, but
it sounds a very German name. I blame the Germans.
It's called the Imperial System.
It's called Fahrenheit. I do not think that is a native Brit from the 1700s.
Okay, but yeah, your average temperatures humans would experience in Europe are between 0 and 100 degrees.
Sure.
That isn't unreasonable.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. America just has refused to, well, change at all since the 1800s, really. Mostly.
As you can see
systems.
By the events of the last week, yeah, basically, we are still in the 1800s.
Yeah.
A little bit of the 1950s thrown in there,
too. Clinging to the imperial system is a weird one. Although they are, you know, imperial. That's, I guess it tracks.
Yeah. Now, what's crazy, though, is the U.S. has officially been a metric country since 1888.
Really?
Yeah.
How officially, though? Because that seems
wrong. Official unit of measure for the U.S. is the metric system based off of the SI standards. And all of the imperial units of measure in the U.S. are officially defined based off of the metric originals.
Got it. So that, okay. I guess that makes sense. It's stupid, but it makes sense.
But like most manufacturing has switched over. It's really just things like replacing all the road signs.
Yeah. Well, see, I mean, in the UK, we still have the road signs are all in miles an hour.
Yeah.
Even though we're technically a metric country, all are. And we still do some weird stuff. So actually, I'd have no right to complain to you. Like, not
okay,
only do we
since
use...
we're on this argument of units of measure, I just want to bring this up. Benedict, what the hell is a shilling?
Okay, I'll come back to it. I'm just going to say, we still
okay,
do...
Okay, then how
like,
much is a farthing?
Not only do we do
how
pounds,
much is a quid?
We do stone. So we do stone pounds
that's
and ounces.
That's right. I do see people occasionally saying they weigh X number of stone. Which and I'm is like, what? How is that a useful unit of measure?
So
that's just some guy at some point pointed at a stone and said, we're going off of that. That rock. That's the rock.
I mean, to be
which
fair,
all
that's
will
kind
be
of,
weighed.
That's kind of what they did with the kilogram. They were like, this is a kilogram. This is what we will measure all kilograms against.
No, because kilograms has a direct relationship to mass.
Now,
there's actually a scientific nature to the kilogram.
But if you ever get a weight scale calibrated, the people who come to verify the weights are going to show up with a giant, basically stone, and put it on the scale.
Yeah, that weighs exactly an amount that they know that it weighs. So yeah, that right. is kind of how... Anyway, there are 16 ounces in a pound and 14 pounds in a stone for some reason, just to confuse everything even more. Very weird. Shilling is a now defunct form of British currency after we decimalized everything in the 70s, I think, which is remarkably recent. And then, yeah, the farthing was a different defunct kind of, along with the halfpenny, which was half a penny.
Okay,
and
so a quid
is a pound. Like, that's like a buck. It's just like slang okay. for it's
all right,
slang
now
for
I'm
pound.
Clear. We can move on to more important things.
All right, so tell us about your podcast.
Oh, man.
I'll let Kevin do that.
I knew you were going to, which is why I started speaking on top of you. So we started off doing a podcast years ago. I think we've been podcasting for, what, 3 years now or so, Benedict?
About that, yeah. About
yeah.
That.
And,
on and off. On and off.
Yeah, on and off. Towards the end of that, we've occasionally taken summer vacations. And towards the end of that, we started doing a series at the end of each show where our last segment, usually 30 minutes or so, was a book review. And it became, pretty quickly, probably our most popular thing. And the book we started with was Dinesh D'Souza's The Big Lie, Exposing the Nazi Roots of the American Left.
Was that the first one we did, really?
Oh,
it was. It was the first one. That was a trip, to tell you the least. And I sort of have, because I grew up, you know, in a Republican household and took a hard right turn around the early high school years. And so for a good portion of my life, I was a right-wing douchebag and a terrible person. And so
now
I
just
had,
a terrible person.
True. I had consumed a lot of this right-wing media at the time. And now that I've changed my entire life, I can stand back in an ironic distance and really actually sort of enjoy it to some extent. There's some things I enjoy very little, like that we're actually recording after we get done with you today, a chapter which is in Donnie Jr.'s book, which is what we're reviewing right now. It's Triggered, in case anyone hasn't heard of it. And it's all a anti-trans chapter, which is just gross and disgusting.
Yeah.
It's really, really bad. I mean, like the Dinesh D'Souza stuff, right? He said in that book, literally, he thinks that Democrats and the Nazis are basically the same. It's not very much hyperbole in me saying that's his main point.
Yeah.
Benedict will agree with me.
No,
I do. He's basically, I think he does say explicitly at some point that that is actually his point. I don't
Well,
remember
he's like, Democrats were the KKK. And
so they
it.
Are now.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
I mean, that's essentially the thrust
okay.
of the book.
That kind of stuff is fun and loopy because it's so wackadoo and so out there, you can make fun of it a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, like, there's a tangible thing that you can, like, ground an argument in. Like, Democrats were the KKK. Yes, mm-hmm. they were. That is true.
Now, do the next sentence, Danette.
Yeah.
She never does.
Now what?
So, yeah, we review these books. You know, honestly, there's several reasons why we do it. One, I enjoy the books from that ironic distance I'm able to stand back and look at.
I do not.
Two, I enjoy making Benedict suffer, which is always a bonus. Three, I think it is important to look at the things that major figures on the right are saying and to know what they're... Because if we don't know what they're saying, then when we argue with them, we're just creating straw men of their positions. And I think it's important also because they're putting forward some really dangerous and terrible ideas in a lot of cases. Dinesh D'Souza being one of the big examples. Donnie Jr., I can say honestly, doesn't actually put forward many ideas. It's really just like a long Twitter thread of arguing against people who aren't there to defend themselves and leaving out all kinds of information, just straight up lying in a number of places.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it is important to look at a lot of these things that they're saying over there and know about them, understand them, try and know how they got to where they are and why they're so fucking wrong.
I think that my favorite bit about Don Jr.'s book is I think every person that's come on our podcast to talk about it has said this is it's called Triggered. And literally, it is just a list of all the little things that have happened in the last 3 years that have really upset him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it really so it's is. Like, triggered. Yes, I am triggered. That is... Yeah.
They've also all said, fuck you at the beginning of every record, but I cut that out so nobody hears it.
Yeah, I believe I did.
Fuck you for making me read this book is a pretty standard thing our guests say.
It is absolute trash.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the other books that we've read, and I think this is probably one of the more interesting ones, was The Faith of Donald J. Trump,
A
spiritual biography, which Ben, I see now, has completely forgotten about.
I blacked out.
What?
Honestly. Like,
yes. It's written by two guys who are CBN reporters, Christian Broadcasting Network, which I think is Pat Robertson's channel, if I'm getting them all. I don't remember.
He's 700 Club.
Bunch of those. Yeah, but
it's somebody else.
Channel?
It's the 700.
Whoever runs CBN, maybe it's Falwell. The Christian Broadcasting Network. I don't know who owns the network. I'm not familiar. I don't remember. But it's David Brody and Scott Lamb, who are two guys. I think both of them work for CBN.
700 Club airs on CBN.
Okay, so yeah, it's related. But David Brody, I think, is the major CBN reporter. And like, you can look him up on Twitter. He's just a right-wing douchebag. But it's so interesting, because I you know, before we start reading these books, I research all the authors. I follow them on all the social medias and get to know what they're saying and how they act. And all these people, with maybe the exception of Donnie Jr., comport themselves in a completely different way on social media than they do in their books, where they try to put on the veneer of academia and pretend that they're being honest and putting forth arguments and all these things. And so it really is strange. But the faith of Donald J. Trump was one, and this is like literally first half of the book, second half of the book, one half obscure Christian history of the region in the United States that Donald Trump grew up in and the place where his immigrant mother or grandmother grew up in.
Oh,
that was
weird.
Basically the first half of the book. Because the point they're trying to make, basically what they say throughout the book, their point is Donald Trump is the Christian. He is the perfect Christian. He is everything we could want from a Christian.
In the second part of the book, it's like, yeah, he's not perfect, but he's doing all the Christian shit. Like, it's a very weird, like, switcheroo. And I guess maybe because it has two authors and, like, you can kind of tell who's written which chapter. Like, never write a book with two authors, I would suggest. Right. Just write two different books. Like, that, no editor is going to fix that. Like, it's impossible.
All right, so CBN was founded by Pat Robertson in 1960.
Yeah.
All right.
And it's for me.
The current CEO is Gordon Robertson.
Weird.
Who is the son of Pat Robertson.
It's a very, 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 very weird, but I had forgotten all about it. But it's like, it's that, like, making evangelical excuses for supporting Trump. Like, it's right. The, you know, the abortion stuff and the, the, like,
right.
He may not be perfect, but he's confirming God-believing judges and, like, all that. So, like, it's basically close your eyes and hold your nose. Like, it's fine. But also,
well,
like, he's probably a Christian.
Exactly.
Definitely. Like,
because the whole point of that exploration of the book of what the churches he supposedly went to and got baptized in and all that is, well, these are the types of beliefs that he would have been brought up around, despite there being basically no evidence that he regularly attended church and all
ever.
The evidence to the contrary, that he actually knows anything about religion whatsoever.
Yeah.
Do you guys remember when they were like, what's your favorite Bible verse? And he was like, all of them.
Do you remember that it was David Brody, the author of that book, who asked that question? And he wrote about it in the book?
I had forgotten, but
yes. He wrote about it in the book. And he tried to excuse it away. He's tried to say things like I think someone was saying that Donald Trump had sent them an email asking about Bible verses after Brody asked the question. It was really amazing.
Or like,
and
he followed
just tries
up with
to excuse
an email,
it all away. Yeah, tried to make, well, that's just a sign of how great a Christian he is, that he was asking questions about great Bible verses after lying about knowing Bible verses and having a favorite one.
Yeah, he was like, what's your favorite verse? I think that was what it was. So then it was literally like the school bully, like, trying to read your answers. Mm-hmm. Like, what's your favorite verse, David? Like, fucking...
Really astonishing stuff. So, I mean, that's the kind of stuff we do on the show. We read these books, and in a lot of cases, they're ridiculous. They often obviously make ridiculous points, if they try and make a point at all. And there's some really toxic, dangerous stuff in some of them. I mean, for, you know, the Dinesh D'Souza one being my favorite book we've ever done, for one thing. But also, I think the best example of just crazy, insane, fear-mongering bullshit on the part of Dinesh D'Souza, and that's really no surprise, knowing Dinesh D'Souza's history and career.
Yeah, you mean criminal felon, Dinesh D'Souza, yeah. although he was pardoned, wasn't he? So do
yes,
you still
but
get
by
to
Trump.
Still,
still a
yeah,
felon.
By Trump. Oh, you're still a felon.
Just,
oh,
just a pardoned felon.
Okay, it doesn't reverse the crime, you're like, oh, it's still a felon. Okay,
as part
cool.
of accepting a pardon, you have to accept the crime. You have to say, you have to accept responsibility for the crime.
So, I mean, but like, the last chapter of that book is basically like, how to solve the Democrat problem,
yes.
essentially. And it's basically like, identify all Democrats and criminally prosecute them before they can do it to us. Like, it's
His
it's pretty gross.
Oh, wow.
I don't have that book anymore. I don't have a copy of it on me anymore. But the last chapter that I believe was called, like, it was something like about how to solve the fascism problem in the United States, right? How to fix fascism.
Yeah. As in democratic fascism.
Yeah. His solution for fixing fascism was fascism. It was arrest and prosecute all of my Democrat enemies, stack the courts with Republicans. And he said that pretty explicitly, not just conservatives, people who are loyal to the Republican Party and on and things like that. It's pretty ridiculous.
Wow.
There's very little self-awareness.
So, and he doesn't realize that on the political spectrum, Nazis are and fascists are far right.
Well, oh, there's a whole chapter about that. There is a whole chapter
about
how they
I'm sorry, that's the point of the whole book, Benedict.
Yeah, that's true.
He tries to argue, and Benedict's sort of right. He sort of glosses over it in a chapter and then takes it as a given throughout the rest of the book, a strategy I like to call the snowball of bullshit, also known as the snowball of inferences. But so he sort of glosses over that. But one of his main thrusts, if you're to accept that there is one, is that there's a giant conspiracy on the left, led by academia, the media, and Hollywood, I think was one of his other ones.
Hollywood was, yeah.
Yes. to paint fascism as a right-wing thing, when in reality it's left-wing. So, and he uses the term leftist a lot, right? If you find replaced in that book the word leftist with Jew, you would have Mein Kampf. You cannot get satire as good as the fucking books they write seriously.
Yeah. So,
because
it's
always Hollywood, academia, and what was the other one I'm blanking on
right
now? I don't know why.
The media,
right?
Media.
The same things that the Nazis said the Jews were all in control of. It's all that same shit.
Yeah.
It's exactly the guy.
So, I mean, there are a few ways he tries to do this as well. So one of the main ones being, like, they're not called National Socialists for nothing, which is, you know, how words work.
Socialists. They said it, so they are. And you know, if there's anybody we can trust, it's the Nazis.
And then he was like, you know, Mussolini started out as a socialist and then doesn't say, like, what happened between that and the fascism, really. Which was, you know, that it didn't, there were a few steps between that. And then he was like, and then FDR did many similar programs to help the recovery as the Nazis were proposing. So obviously it's all left wing. Like, and then isn't there a bit where he was like, oh, and the Nazis were fine with, like, gay people?
Yes. Okay. So I told you, right, one of the reasons we do this is the heinous ideas that I think it's valuable to challenge.
It's just misreading of history also.
Well, it is completely misreading of history, but he stumbles into, and this is there are common threads that run through all of these books, right? And LGBTQ hate is common among the right wing. It's just there on all of them. There are a couple
and also
of
something
leaders.
Nazis were up on.
Yeah.
Nazis really hated the LGBT community.
Yeah. You know, there are a couple of hard libertarians among the right who are very pro-LGBTQ rights and things, and good on them. I'm still going to criticize them for all the other nonsense, but good on them for that part. I'll support them on being pro-LGBTQ rights. But Dinesh says in that book that the Nazis were actually pro-gay. And the only reason that the Night of the Long Knives and all that happened, and the gay Nazis being taken away, was because they were trying to usurp power. It had nothing to do with the Nazis being anti-gay.
Yeah, he was
ergo,
like, there were a couple
ergo,
of gay
the next,
people.
The problem, okay, that's just historical revisionism and nonsense. The problem is the next step he takes, where he uses that to say, so Hitler couldn't be a conservative on social issues. Ergo, a conservative on social issues, which Dinesh thinks is a positive, should want to kill all the gays?
Which Hitler
it's
did.
Very difficult. Yeah.
Hitler rounded up all the gays he could and sent them to death camps.
Yeah, including Ernst Röhm, who I think was gay. He was...
Ernst Röhm was the big example. Exactly.
Yeah, he was
Ernst
like,
Röhm
well,
was
Ernst Röhm
example.
Was high up in the Nazi party. And it was like, yeah, what the fuck happened to him, Dinesh?
Right.
He didn't survive the war.
Like, the whole history of fucking pink triangles and the horrible things that were done to gays by the Nazis, it's all swept under the rug by Dinesh and his ilk, because they want to pretend that, no, Hitler wasn't right-wing. He was actually left-wing. That's the main thrust of the book, right? And they're playing off of this confusing, not understanding that history happens and times change and ideas change. And I think the most hilarious example of that was when we reviewed his documentary, which was based on the book, The Big Lie, where he interviewed Richard Spencer, which to this day is the single greatest 5 minutes I have seen in my life, where we did the review with Thomas Smith and Aaron Rabbi. And I think either Thomas or Aaron described it as two bullshitters not being able to get the other one to do the right bullshit at the moment, where Dinesh is asking Richard Spencer, like, who's your favorite presidents? And he says, like, I don't remember what he says, but
there's Andrew Jackson because of all the murdering,
Polk, I think, or something like that. And Dinesh says, oh, well, you know, those are all Democrats. And for the life of me, I'll never get over the fact that I laughed at something Richard Spencer said and completely agreed at the same time, where he said, well, yeah, man, but party's just a vessel and ideology changes over time. It was just so beautiful because there's this bullshitter sitting here being told that he's completely wrong and by someone who's actually right, who's also a terrible heart. It's just amazing. Don't watch that movie, but watch that 5 minutes. It's probably on YouTube.
Yeah, and then it was like they were the very obvious point that was made was like, basically, this is just boring Reaganism. Like, there's nothing exciting about anything that you're saying. Like, it's just weird Reaganism that you're like... Because Dinesh was a Reagan... I think he was a Reagan employee. Certainly
yes,
a Reagan,
he was in the Reagan White House.
Yeah. So... Very weird. And then I would say there are bits of that movie that are worth watching, especially when I think it's his wife just like sings America the Beautiful to an empty theater hall. It's
so, to answer your question, this is what we do with our podcast.
Yeah, long story short.
Okay, so you read bullshit and then talk about it. And then bullshit
talk
about it.
About it. Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's essentially it, yeah.
And I mean, you know, we try and mix it up what we talk about. Obviously, it's mainly political. We've done a little bit of the religious stuff. You know, we're both atheists, and I think maybe a little softer on religion than some people are, because I think that, like we've seen in the modern United States, demonizing particular religious groups causes some problems. See the treatment of Muslims circa now.
I think I think a couple of years ago I was a lot harder on religion than I am now, just for like, that seems like there are bigger problems right now.
But I think I was gonna say that's exactly part of it. I think part of it is, like, you know, we started out our first podcast and we were always talking about religious issues, and, you know, we tried to stay political because there's lots of other atheist podcasts out there who are doing this stuff every day and much better than we can do. But we're very political guys. I was a political science major in undergrad at UC Berkeley, and Bendix, you know, has a smart sounding voice.
That's right.
So we tried to stick to more political stuff. And I think, you know, we tried to do a little bit more religious stuff. We did the Faith of Donald J. Trump book. But then, you know, we all just get swept up in the fact that right now we are living in this nightmare hellscape of a political party that is being usurped by Christian nationalists. So it does tie in. It ultimately always does tie in, because the Republican Party is being usurped completely by right-wing Christian nationalism, which threatens everything for so many of us who just want to live our lives in peace without having other people's religions forced on us. But, you know, we're forced to always focus on what's going on in the political arena, and that's where we found ourselves, right? Obviously, doing this book triggered by Donnie Jr., which doesn't put forward any real political points. It doesn't make any unique arguments. It doesn't put forward any real... strenuous thinking or logic or anything like that on any sort of issues. It's just recycled talking points he's probably scraped off of Twitter and Conservapedia about random people he's angry at. And I think we want to get back into more of the real people trying to put forward crazy ideas like Dinesh D'Souza, but we're sort of back on our heels right now, just trying to deal with the bullshit that's at the top level, the most high-profile bullshitters out there. I think is why we sort of decided the first book we would do when we restarted the podcast and rebranded and did all this was the Donald Trump Jr. book. We sort of had to.
Yeah, and that's a really fair point. It's like, yeah, right now you can't do a atheist podcast without talking about politics, and you can't do a political podcast without talking about religion.
Yeah, everything's commingled right now.
I think it always has been to an extent. I think maybe they were easier to separate in terms of policy back in the day.
Or I think it has, but I think
successful policy.
I think the big point is that, you know, my whole life, maybe the 90s onwards, we have had what seems like, and even during the times when I was a right-wing douchebag, we have had what seems like a progression from a control of a all-powerful religious monopoly of Christians in the United States, where now we, towards where we are now, where we see expansion of the people who have no particular religious ideology, more atheists, all these sorts of things. And I mean, like, for me, for an example, the Obergefell case, I was still a right-wing douchebag at that time. And, like, one of the big regrets of my life is that I wasn't able to share in the joy of people who were cheering when they ran out of the Supreme Court building telling people what the ruling was. Like, I was on the other side of that at the time.
Mm.
And I'll never be able to go back in time and understand what that emotion was like and what it felt like. So that's, you know, what I'm saying is we've been moving towards less of that. And then 2016 happens. And I don't think anyone can deny that Donald Trump, because he has pretty explicitly catered to the hardcore religious right, mm-hmm. Has brought back that creeping religious Christian nationalism.
And what's so crazy with it is Donald Trump is not very religious, if at all.
Probably the first atheist president.
Penn Jillette says he was an atheist. Yeah, Penn Jillette believes he was an atheist, I don't know if I agree with Penn to that extent, that he was an atheist in the way that you and I and Benedict think of atheists, right? People who have made a conscious decision and thought about religion, looked at the arguments, and said, "I just don't think this is true," right? I don't think that he's that. I think it's possible that at the time he was a sort of guy who just was always like, there's this religious stuff over there. I'm just doing my thing. I'm just not gonna worry about any of that. I'm just over here cheating on my wives with hookers."
There is no way he thinks there is a higher power in the world than him. Like, that, I just...
Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, well...
Who the religious right also really likes.
Weird.
Right? Because he's bringing the church back in Russia. The mm-hmm. Russian Orthodox Church is big under him, and he really supports it. And the anti-LGBTQ stuff, of course.
Yeah.
Which he's huge on, and a lot of that region of the world is unfortunately pretty big on.
Right, because Putin wants to bring back the Russian Empire with himself as the emperor, and he is slowly, slowly making that happen, including a return to nationality, orthodoxy, and autocracy, which was the big philosophy of 19th century Russian politics.
Yeah, that didn't end well for them, though.
No! Because it turned out people like having, you know, the Not ability to marry who they want and live where they want.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it all comes together, man. Like, you see this all over the world, right? And my specialty when I was studying political science was Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia has a definite creeping authoritarian problem. And there is always religion mixed in with it these days. Look at Duterte, who's probably the prime example right now going on in that region of the world. And because Indonesia and Malaysia are much more complicated and have different things going on. But Duterte, they're much more complicated. There's a lot of craziness going on there that I love, but it's less related to religion because they're more homogenized over there. And they actually, I would say Malaysia, because it had this big strife in the 60s dealing with their many religious groups and ethnic groups, are much better at it now than a lot of places in the world, although there still are issues there.
Right, Malaysia, where you can be Muslim or Christian or Buddhist. Those are your choices.
Yes.
Unless you were born into a Muslim family, and then you're stuck.
Yes, yes. And there's similar laws in Indonesia. But they don't have the sort of conflict, I think, that we see in a lot of places, which is interesting. It's a very interesting issue going on in those regions of the world. Of course, atheists still have it terrible all over that place.
Oh, yeah.
But Duterte, I think, being the prime example of rising Christian nationalism in Southeast Asia, and then you see things like Bolsonaro in Brazil, and all over the world, there's this sort of rise in religious fundamentalism. And I did a lot of work in that sort of arena in undergrad as well, looking at fundamentalism. And fundamentalism, I think, the view I share with the writers of the big treatises on the subject, like the Fundamentalism Project, University of Chicago, is that fundamentalism is a reaction to secularization. So when you have broad periods of secularization, you're going to see a backlash because there's going to be an in-grouping, out-grouping. There's going to be cloistered communities of faith that are telling themselves that they need to protect the faith, whatever their idea of the faith is, from the outsiders, the secularists who are threatening the faith, and they transform that into a political backlash. And nowadays, through social media and communication, they have an ability to do that on a larger scale.
Well, for a good example on it, if you look at like Iran and Afghanistan in the 1970s, women wore jeans and t-shirts in public with no face coverings. People basically wore Western clothing. That was also true in Jordan and Lebanon and Syria and much of the Middle East. And the more conservative-minded saw that and freaked out about the secularizing and Westernizing of their culture. And we've seen a major, major backlash against that. The Taliban in Afghanistan, the Taliban in Afghanistan was as much in response to that as it was to the Soviets. Yep. And the Iranian Revolution was directly in response to that.
Yeah. I don't know how big your listeners are on reading. We happen to be, if you can't tell, as a book club, big on reading. But there's a great primer on fundamentalism called Strong Religion. It comes out of the University of Chicago Fundamentalism Project. It's a fantastic read and one I relied on heavily for a lot of the work I did in undergrad on that sort of area.
Yeah, I would also recommend, just on Iran, like, I think it's a little, you have to look at the first revolution that America basically did before the second revolution, when Mossadegh was overthrown and killed, basically, by the CIA. Not to get it all, CIA killed everyone, but that created conditions that allowed for a fundamentalist takeover.
But the CIA did kill everyone.
When you combine the natural westernizing and secularizing of society, plus the U.S. fucking around with internal politics, yes, you get a major, major backlash.
Yeah, because then obviously people within the country say the West is trying to fuck us over, because often we are.
Yes. Like,
and so I think that the differentiation is the mingling in the West, or the causing of disruption, whatever it is the West does, in other regions, I should say, not in the West, but whatever the West does that causes disruptions in these areas of the world allows for the opening for fundamentalists and for hardcore extremists to come in and say, I provide a better path, because people are upset. People are looking for a direction. And when you have a bunch of people with no clear purpose, and as we saw in the Iranian revolution, where that revolution was pretty much about throwing out the leadership at that time. It didn't have a direction for weeks or months until it had been ongoing. It was really that creating that gap provided a space for the extremists to come in and take control, take power, and put in their regime. And so that's why I don't think it's a direct correlation to what's going on in the U.S. I think the other stuff like Bolsonaro, Duterte, Putin, those are probably better examples that correlate a little better with what's going on in the West, where there's really an actual, to some extent, grassroots level, and much more there, I think, than in the U.S. We have a lot of astroturfing here in the U.S.
Like that word.
Right. But you'd like it on your head, wouldn't you?
I would.
But there's a lot more genuine grassroots sort of stuff going on in free democratic countries that aren't undergoing a revolution at the time that are pushing this swelling Christian nationalism.
Yeah.
There's also, I mean, there's the temptation to look at this as kind of unique to right now, but the needle always moves back and forth between populism and not populism, and leadership through authority figures, like, and also between, as you say, like fundamentalism and more secularization. It's happened for centuries, and you hope that it moves back slightly less than it was previously every time it goes back each way. And
I'd say, to be fair, especially when you're getting into the long arc of history, you hope it doesn't lead to the death of a 20% of your population.
Ideally, Yeah.
Which often ideally. Happens.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in an ideal world, Dustin, we can't ask for too much.
I mean, look, it's happened even on a small level. Like, right, look at COVID. Look at what's going on with COVID. Mm-hmm. Just last night, the Supreme Court
a small level.
middle of the night decision by the Supreme Court that California is allowed to keep their rules in place regarding restrictions on religious gatherings, right? And I think Kavanaugh wrote a dissent about how they should treat religious gatherings like any other business, ignoring that that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they're just determining that they're not essential. So, duh.
Mm-hmm.
But that sort of thing, like you're talking about, killing 20, maybe not 20% of the people, but putting people at risk in requiring them to attend a gathering, which is definitely detrimental to their health. For the primary purpose, and there are definitely genuine religious figures out there who think that this is something we have to do because it's a stricture of our faith, yada, yada, mm-hmm. yada. There are a hell of a lot of Christian churches in the United States that really want that damn money that they get in the collection basket every week, and that's why they need people to come out. I know Paula White Kane, her church doesn't need the money. I know her church is doing just fine. But she's out there screaming that churches need to be back in session and her church needs to be allowed to all that kind of stuff.
But then
it's just ridiculous.
Then you look at the Catholics who, to them, attendance at Easter is when almost everybody shows up.
I grew up Catholic, for the record. Christmas and Easter, only two times you go to church as a Catholic, unless you're 80.
And Easter was shut down in almost every state in the U.S.
Yep.
Yeah, actually in most of the world. Catholics just... They didn't skip Easter, but they didn't hold services.
Yeah,
nobody got mass.
It'd be a shame if they were forced to pull some of that money out of the graveyard funds and put it into keeping their churches running, wouldn't it?
My favorite bit of that was when the Pope was like, yeah, maybe it is a private thing between you and God. And there was a meme of Martin Luther just being like, vindication.
I did enjoy that as well. I really did.
Well, okay, so... on that point, though, Martin Luther, in response to Martin Luther, there was the Counter-Reformation that mm-hmm. the Catholics had.
Council
which
of Trent.
Famously. Caused the Catholic Church to change almost as much as Luther changed from Catholic.
Yeah.
Right, and I would, look, so here's the thing. Growing up Catholic, right? Your non-Catholic friends, who as children, right, are taken to Episcopalian churches or evangelical churches, whatever the case may be. They think that Catholic churches are radically different and in some way mysterious and crazy, something. They ask all these weird questions to you as a child, as a Catholic child. Like, for example, I got plenty of times, why do you worship Mary? Which isn't accurate in any sort of way. Like, the Catholics don't worship Mary. Like, they pray to Mary as an intercessor, right? They believe
which,
that Mary
to Protestants,
is a special place.
That is worshiping.
Right, right. But, you know, tomato, tomato. I think there's a little bit of a differentiation without a difference.
Oh, yeah.
But, and then there's other things, for example, right? The confession is sort of a strange and mysterious rite to a lot of people. But the main point being, the Catholic Church is remarkably more similar to a lot of the, because I've been to the evangelical churches, right? My aunt went to a mega church in Sacramento. And so I was forced to go there a couple times when she was watching us when our parents were out of town, even though our parents never took us to church, basically. But I found, like, okay, there's music and stuff. But other than that, it's just like we're sitting around for a couple hours. We have some crackers and juice, and then we go home. There's really not all that difference on a broad level from all the various religious practices in the United States. And I think there's who's the comedian that does the bit – are you Northeastern Congregational Baptist, or you you know that whole long bit? I think these differentiations in a lot of cases are pretty ridiculous, particularly because I had friends as a child who would say, "Oh, you're Catholic, you're not a Christian," which is stupid because there is one qualification to be called a Christian, and it's believing in Jesus Christ, and that's it. There's literally nothing else that could help you qualify.
Well, I mean, it's Jesus Christ died for our sins, right? Is the actual,
you know what I mean, Benedict?
Okay, all right, sure. But okay. Catholics were pretty much the original Christians, so I think they get the rights. But they do.
Y'all can't
I have
see me, but I'm doing
that.
An OG symbol right now.
Yeah, I have noticed that here. It's very strange that, like, it is often designated of, like, when you're doing, like, a census or whatever, it's, like, Christian, this, and then Catholic as, like, a separate non-subdivision of Christian.
Right.
Yeah.
Because Americans have been bashing on Catholics forever.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, like, heck, Massachusetts, the colonies that end up creating Massachusetts, no Catholics allowed there.
Yeah, until JFK.
Yeah.
I think he was the first one, actually.
There's this town called Boston. I don't know if you've heard
Then
of
a
it.
Bunch of Irish people
Check out
moved
a movie
in.
Called Spotlight. They talk about them a lot there.
But yeah, like, it was founded on basically no Catholics, and... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because then that's what the pilgrims wanted. They wanted to exclude people that didn't practice their specific religion. That was the whole reason they came.
Yeah. No Catholics, no Church of England.
Exactly.
And nobody else existed.
The Church of England, by the way, is the most toothless religion that exists. I don't think there's even a hell anymore. Like, it's, yeah. They were just like, maybe we just close hell.
Do all dogs go to heaven in the Church of England?
Everyone goes to heaven, I think.
Yeah, but they have like a third of the seats of the House of Lords.
Yeah, the House of Lords is very weird. It's a very strange place.
I've tried to get Benedict to explain the House of Lords to me like 15 times, and every time I have no idea why that's a thing. Nobody can explain to me why
really
it still
weird.
Is.
It's like there are some hereditary peerages and some that are just like, here's a reward for your years of service. Like, it's very odd.
The peerages.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's the hereditary seats, there's the peerages, which I finally looked that one up a while ago, and the title of Baron was originally so that a king could have friends.
It's essentially, yes.
That's like going way, way back, but yeah, you'd find, he would find his fighting buddies and make them barons who would be, you know, lords of the court without any actual land holdings, and it wasn't hereditary, it was just... This guy's going to be a lord, so he can hang out in court and
be
a buddy. It's the original rich kid frat.
Yeah.
Drinking buddies for the king.
But then the problem was that the barons had too much power. They were all like, we're really good at fighting. We shouldn't let King John have as much power over us as he does. And that's why the Magna Carta exists.
Yep. His drinking buddies decided they wanted the power.
And then in World War II, Baron Zemo came around. There was this whole thing with the Tesseract. It was all a big deal. Really ruined it all for everybody.
But yeah, so yeah, I looked that one up. And yeah, the barons, so they still have seats on the House of Lords. Because of basically the Magna Carta, which was their deal.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, the Magna Carta is much more important.
And then everybody else has...
Great album.
Everybody else has just been added in later.
Pretty much, yeah. So, I mean, a lot of it now is just like a reward for... But it's weird, because it's such a, like, again, we love to have toothless institutions. It's such a toothless second house of power. Like, basically, they can't say no... to anything that they are legally prohibited to vote no on anything that the proposing party proposed in their manifesto for the election. So if a party wins by the popular vote and they proposed something in their manifesto and then it gets passed in the lower house, the upper house can't say no to it.
So what happens now where nobody wins in the popular vote?
Well, so now the Tories are in charge. So whoever is the largest party in the House of Commons, essentially, they had a manifesto. And if they pass something in the House of Commons that was in their manifesto, then the House of Lords has no power to stop it.
I love that you just honestly call it a manifesto. That's for the Tories. It's just a Tory manifesto. Yeah. It just sounds like the most honest thing I could imagine.
I mean, that's what it's called. The parties have manifestos that are not the same as the Unabomber manifesto, fortunately, for the most part. Although, you know, we do have some great... Are you familiar with Lord Buckethead, Dustin?
Yeah.
There's a Lord Buckethead?
There's a Lord Buckethead.
So, in the
UK... Anybody can run for a seat, and what often happens is Lord Buckethead is, I think he bills himself as an intergalactic space being, and he is...
Space Lord,
surely. And he is, I think, like 9 foot tall, He just has a massive head. Like, it's a 3-foot tall head that looks like a knight's helmet.
Okay.
And he always...
It's a guy in a costume. Yeah, Let's be clear what's going on here.
But
I don't want anyone getting the wrong idea.
He always
that
Andre
runs, the Giant came back.
He always runs against, like, whoever is running for the leadership of one of the main parties. So in 2017, when Theresa May was running for her re-election, she was up on stage with a guy in like a Lord Buckethead costume who first ran against Margaret Thatcher, which is just incredible.
All right. Well, we've got somebody in Idaho who legally changes name to pro-life and runs for governor every year. And so the BBC covered an Idaho Republican primary gubernatorial debate. This would have been 2014 when pro-life was the second most crazy of the four.
Wow. And the first was your current governor?
No. He was actually the most former governor now, but he was the most reasonable. Butch Otter was terrible, but everybody running against him was so much worse.
I don't want to know how many votes pro-life got. I really don't want to know.
He gets a couple hundred usually.
Oh, I'm surprised it's not more.
Yeah.
Just by some Christians looking at a ballot and seeing pro-life and reflexively marking it down.
Oh, no. They mostly just vote for the establishment Republican.
I mean, that would presumably accomplish the same. Anyway, he runs for the monster raving loony party, which is perhaps the best thing about him.
So in sum, British politics are just slightly better than our own.
He also morphed into, I believe, Count Binface for the latest election. He changed his name to Count Binface. We have fun with it. And like, they're always up, they make them all stand on stage together
But here's the benefit I see of British, but I don't even think everyone gets that there's a huge benefit to the multi-party system and multi-member districts and all that sort of stuff that happens in British politics and the parliamentary system, is that the wackadoo crazy parties, UKIP and Brexit Party and all those, are actually separate from the Tories.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see who the real crazy is.
Except,
and I think there's such huge benefit in that.
But both of those have been merged into the Tories.
Kind of, yeah. So, and the Tories are like, they are...
Well, not UKIP.
No, UKIP... Well, UKIP basically lost all support.
UKIP voters would go for the Tories because they realize UKIP isn't going to win.
The Tories essentially adopted some UKIP policies to win UKIP voters after... Most of the driving force behind UKIP formed what became the Brexit Party. So,
yeah,
right. Here's the benefit I'm talking about. In the United States, the Republican Party would just explicitly glom onto anti-Muslim rhetoric and the hate speech and all that sort of stuff that the farthest fringes of the right wing are speaking in order to gain them. In the UK, they may sort of adopt some of those things, but even your standard Tory leadership aren't crazy enough to actually go out there and push all the insane rhetoric of UKIP.
Except Boris Johnson. Wasn't he UKIP?
No, he was never UKIP.
No.
I mean, he campaigned for Brexit, but he's always been a Tory.
Okay.
UKIP's main thing is anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim hate. Right, and I don't remember who's the... There's a lot of big figures in UKIP, but
Farage,
who's the guy that kept getting...
Farage.
Oh, that's right.
Tommy Robinson.
No, he wasn't UKIP. He was BNP.
Oh, you're right. Okay, I got that mixed up. But
Then subsequently Pegida, I believe.
Yeah. And then Farage, of course, comes over here and does multi-state tours of college Republican clubs on U.S. campuses.
Because here's where the money is. There's no money
because
in...
the most extreme of the British right... are today's standard Republican youth ideology.
Yeah.
Cool.
Now, the downside of the way the British do it, though, is you have a multi-party system, but it's winner-take-all, which means there's only two viable parties.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, it kind of got broken up. So, quite recently, actually, there was a coalition. So, like, there's always a majority party, but between 2010 and 2015... the Liberal Democrats allied with the Conservatives to put the Conservatives in power. And like the Liberal Democrats could have allied with either Labour or the Conservatives, and whoever they allied with would have been in power. So, I mean, what could have happened is what should probably have naturally happened is they should have gone into power with Labour, because they're both nominally, at least, the Labour is a left-wing party, admittedly more centre-left now than maybe it used to be back in the day, and certainly more centre-left right now than it was under Corbyn. And the Liberal Democrats are centre-left, so people would have expected that they would have gone into coalition with Labour, but they chose the Tories for whatever reason. But that's the thing, you get like at least some kingmakers or whatever, so it's kind of like, you know, that you don't really have caucuses in UK politics, because they're just separate parties. Right. So like there's no Tea Party caucus, like, you know, group within the Republican Party. Like, we don't really have that, because you don't need it. Those people would just go form a separate party. So traditionally there have only really been two viable parties, you're right, but like others still have sway, because at the end of the day they still have a vote. Like, they still get a vote in the Commons. And they're underrepresented compared to the share of vote that they get, but a few people will still be elected, and so you do have to build some form of consensus at least.
Which you'd have to look to a more modern democracy like New Zealand's recent recreation of their government, where it is actual direct proportional to the actual way people vote.
Yeah, and you do have to do quite a lot of recreation in order to do that, because at the moment we in the UK, you still have politicians that represent districts, which is harder to do on a proportional basis. And there are advantages and disadvantages to having people actually represent a district and
which, if you do,
accountable to the people.
Like, if you do mixed proportional, though, you can do multiple people representing a larger district
with a number of at-large representatives.
Then they get proportioned based on votes per party in that district.
Well, we try to do the weird halfway thing, where we try to do alternative voting, where you rank candidates by a preference. And we had a referendum on that after. Actually, that was one of the things the Tories promised the Liberal Democrats, that we would have a referendum on whether we would do that so that they would get more power, and it got broadly rejected. So I wish I didn't really know why. It seems like, it certainly seems like an improvement to me. Like, you should be able to rank your preferences.
Either Massachusetts or Maine is doing that now. I don't remember which state off the top of my head.
I believe it's Maine.
I think Maine.
Maine, they are doing ranked choice voting right now, which in the United States is a huge benefit in getting someone else in there besides the two major parties, although it probably still will be, because of history, for a long time, the two major parties who win all of the seats. I think the benefit of the UK system is that those smaller parties, because they are explicitly separate parties, are able to put actual pressure onto the Tories or the Labour Party when they're negotiating to form a coalition, pass laws, get things done, and actually get more of their things through compared to what we see here in the United States, where it's just the two parties are the two players in the game.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, most of the time a coalition doesn't form because the major party doesn't need a coalition partner. So, you know, Europe has many more coalitions just because there are generally more viable parties, and it's rare. So like in Germany, it's rare for a party to win a majority, so they almost always have to form a coalition of some form. Whereas in the UK, normally one of the two major parties wins. So yeah, I mean, the benefit, as far as I see it, is that they tend to, for example, the Green Party, I think, has dragged Labour to a more green vision than they might otherwise have explored, because, you know, a green voter is likely to vote Labour, but if they have another option who's explicitly talking about green projects, Labour needs to take that on, otherwise they'll lose vote share to that. So pulling parties in the right direction, pulling the mainstream parties in a positive direction, and also a negative direction, like UKIP pulled the Tories in a negative direction in terms of anti-immigration rhetoric, but it does pull people away from the same old tired shit that we hear all the time, which I think largely is a good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all, Dustin and I are from the United States. Anything's an improvement, Benedict. Anything's an improvement.
Which is weird, because Madison, when he made the system, was like, I have studied every system in the world, and this is the best that I can come up with.
That's because there weren't even parties yet.
That's true. Right? I think the system he came up with is actually better than what it turned into. Like,
there parties didn't exist at that time. Those didn't come about until the French Revolution. The concept of right and left didn't come about until the French Revolution.
Yeah, it's literally a French Revolution phrase of like the reactionary sat right on the right and the.
But even without explicit parties, people tend to self-segregate themselves into political mm-hmm. ideologies, right? Yeah. That happened early on in the United States, where you had the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, who weren't parties, but they were competing ideologies within the U.S. government at the time. And while people were still voting for individuals and there wasn't a big party identification, it was pretty explicit which way those individuals went on those issues of anti-federalism or federalism. And you look at issues like the bank crisis early on in the United States, the National Bank and things like that. And so it's pretty explicit how that went.
Yeah.
But as we know, we cannot question the founders. The founders are perfect. Everything they thought, oh, shit.
Except the Electoral clause. College, which we have substantially changed since they
came
up with
it. I was
going to
say three-fifths clause, but fine, you go with the other one. Yeah. That's
I mean,
not
that's
as
the
clear of
one.
An example.
That's the obvious. You know, you're correct. You picked the obvious one.
Yeah, I did.
And yeah, also just all of slavery.
And the whole... In addition to the three-fifths compromise, there was also the whole Indians not taxed.
Yep.
Not being
well,
counted.
So that clause had to do with that clause is still racist, but slightly less racist, surprisingly, yeah, than the three-fifths clause, because it mainly had to do with the idea that, and at that time, the Native American tribes were dealt with as separate nations, mm-hmm, pretty explicitly. And so they were not to be counted as part of the U.S. population. So that's more what that had to do with. There's still some racism involved there, obviously. Because
like the fact that they were on U.S. territory.
Right. Right.
Like,
exactly.
Yeah. That shouldn't have been
that's
U.S. territory.
Ours now.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, a long history of U.S. racism. Cool. Which continues through the books we read today.
Yeah. Check us out.
And, you know, as of release, we're recording this the weekend that everything's on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I am in D.C. right now. I got back from California. And I will most likely be going out there tonight to act as a legal observer, and ensure that, well, do what I can to make sure that nobody's rights are being violated. You know, it's sad right now what's going on, man. Like, it shouldn't take this to make change. It shouldn't take shit getting set on fire to make change. It really shouldn't. It's sad that this is where our country's coming to. And it's not, I'm not like Republicans are out there saying, oh, they're burning all our stuff. Fuck them. No, it's that we shouldn't have to burn stuff to make change. That video shouldn't have happened. He shouldn't have been choked to death. Just all this shit that's going on, it's so fucking sad. Mm-hmm. And the hardest part of it, I think, is seeing that whenever any slight bit of violence, and we knew this from the beginning, even if they were just perfectly nice protests with no violence, the right would have found a way to say that something untoward was going on. They'd say that Soros is paying for all these protests, whatever the hell the case might have been. And they would have found a way to say that, well, I guess we don't need to worry about George Floyd's death whatsoever because of X.
They didn't like Kaepernick. So that's literally the most peaceful protest that they could have done. So like, all power to the people always. That's all I want to say.
Yeah. But white people with guns can storm the state capitol.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. All power to
your state, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Oh, we had more than just white people with guns at the state capitol. We had white people with guns stalking the Meridian police officer who arrested the woman for violating the park closure and then begging to be arrested. She's the head of, or one of the heads of the local anti-vax group.
And they didn't get pepper sprayed, did they?
Nope.
God.
Nope.
Fucking sucks.
You know, and there are lights to look at from everything that's happened over the last week. There are things like what happened in Flint, where the chief of police, I believe, I think it was the chief of police, had his officers join with the protesters.
Yeah, and Newark through town too. Newark, yeah, New Jersey.
Things like that have happened. So but there are.
This is the thing, like de-escalation. Like there are ways to escalate and de-escalate things, and there are cities mm-hmm. where they escalated and de-escalated things. New York was not a city where they de-escalated things. Yeah. New York was a city where they ran over a crowd of protesters.
Yeah. So I see videos all over also where there are police commissioners and mayors and things who are out there talking to the protesters and actually listening.
Acknowledging too,
acknowledging like, what's going on, and that's so important.
Someone reading the names of people that had died in police custody for no reason.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's not much we can do. I mean, I'm going to be out there tonight as a legal observer. I can't participate, but I'm going to do what I can to document any rights violations and ensure that people are treated. In accordance with the law and the way that they're supposed to be treated by the police, which unfortunately, based on what I've seen of the last couple nights here in DC, that hasn't been the status quo so far.
With impunity on camera. Yeah. They arrested a motherfucker who was reporting on the protests for not moving when he is on camera being like, "Where would you like me to move to?"
Yep.
And if that's what they do on camera, one hates to imagine.
What do they do off camera?
Exactly.
And we know what they do off camera because occasionally we catch it on camera. We saw George Floyd, right? We saw fucking CNN anchor, or I don't remember who was, got arrested live on TV.
Something.
I don't remember who it was. I didn't follow that story very closely. We've seen all this stuff going on, and it's sad. It's really sad, but what can we do? What can we do besides protest, join in, protest where we can, stay peaceful, prevent the people, the agitators who are coming in and trying to cause violence, which the right will use to...
And there is evidence they are.
...blame the left. Yeah.
The right are doing it a lot of the time, we'll say.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going on. And let's be honest, there are also just shitheads out there.
Yeah.
Who just aren't out there because of any political reason, aren't out there for any cause, who just want to break shit, steal shit, whatever the case may be. And those people are just as dangerous to the cause of justice as anything, because they're giving the right the opportunity to say, George Floyd, we don't have to talk about that now, because we just have to talk about how here's this guy breaking a window right here. That's what we have to talk about. So I guess that means the police are justified in kneeling on a guy's neck till he dies.
Well, then you look at like Portland and Seattle, where you've got large groups of fascists and anti-fascists who will counter-protest each other every chance they get. And the police regularly, especially in Portland, have to break up those fights. And this provides the perfect opportunity for them to start a big fight.
Yeah. I mean, I went to UC Berkeley. I was there in the years of the big Berkeley protests. And I was out there at them. And Bendick knows all those stories.
I do.
From those times. And so I've seen it all up close. I've been pepper sprayed. I've gotten it all. And that's exactly what happened. The right-wing protesters absolutely come to fight. Mm-hmm. And then Andy Ngo and people come and get their one-sided footage and put it online and fucking lie about it and pretend that this is just, Antifa, this imaginary organization called Antifa.
That's now been designated a terrorist group, by the way.
Oh, apparently. I saw that earlier today. But there's all kinds of bad shit going on, right? And I care about my listeners. I'm sure you care about your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And I care about people who aren't my listeners. I care about the people who are being damaged by everything that's going on, who are being hurt by police, who are being brutalized. And there is a hard, like, what the fuck do we do? Because nobody seems to be listening for a long time. And I hope that some change comes out of this, because I see people who are listening. I don't know if they're listening in the right places. I don't know if they're listening in New York City, what Benedict's talking about, where police are running over people with an SUV. I don't know if they're listening in cities where the police are gearing up with riot gear and shooting at people with rubber bullets and tear gas and all that. I don't think they're listening in those places. But the reality is that's where they need to listen the most.
Mm-hmm. And if we're lucky, by the time this episode goes up in a week and a half from the day we're recording it, change will be actually in the works. And if we aren't lucky, we will be in the middle of an actual race war.
Oh, I've been listening to too much Alex Jones. I can't deal with race wars. Yeah. God. But you
let's
know,
hope
I,
for the former, eh?
Let's hope for the better. Honestly.
Let's hope cooler cooler heads prevail and Russian trolls don't get their allies in the U.S. to escalate things too much.
Yeah. And vote, people. Vote. That's what matters. I mean, look, Benedict and I, we both supported Bernie, but we don't have him as a choice anymore. And the only way we're going to get the change we want is by voting for the lame, boring fucking Democrat, because we can work on the Democratic Party. They will listen to some extent. We can change their minds. We're not going to change Dinesh D'Souza's mind. We're not going to change Donald Trump Jr.'s mind. So the only thing we could do is try and vote on a local level, vote for your mayor, vote for your city commissioners, vote for all that sort of stuff. Vote for fucking chief of police if you're allowed to vote for it in your city. That shit matters. So if you say you're not showing up to vote, you're not voting for all of those positions as well. You're not voting for the people who control the police and who can make the changes on the issues we're talking about right now.
Yeah. Very well said. Well, we are out of time, so where can people find your show?
So there's a bathroom off of I-5 just outside of Modesto. It's at an AM-PM. I don't know if they have those where you are. AM-PM, greatest gas station on the planet. You go in that bathroom, lift open the toilet tank. There's a USB drive there.
Okay.
On that USB drive is a map. No. We can be found on all the usual podcast places, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, all that stuff. Just search for Not Your Grandmother's Book Club. You can also find us on Facebook at NYGBC Pod, I think it is right now. And, of course, we can found on the Twitter at NYGBC Pod.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview. I'm going to say that's it for this week because we went a little bit long. Don't forget the live stream on June 23 at 8:30 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time. So join in for the live stream if you want. If not, that episode will just be out on the 25th. And then we'll be taking the next week off. You can find details soon at atheistnomads.com/live. Or just find us on YouTube or Patreon or join us on the Discord channel. Until next week, remember, not all those who wander are lost. Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.